Welcome to the brand called You. Today I have someone who I hold in very, very high regard. He's a surgeon, he's a poet, and a very, very accomplished individual. Dr. Vidur Jyoti, welcome to the show. Dr. Jyoti is a minimal access and general surgeon. He's the head of surgery at Max Hospital, Gurgaon. He's involved in the private healthcare sector since 1983. He's worked at various medical facilities of different sizes and ownership complexities. He's interested in searching the meaning of life through lessons learned from professional interactions with patients, and I'm going to ask you about that. And he's a published haiku poet. So before we get into other parts, would you please talk to us about the 36 years of experience in healthcare and tell us some of your challenges and your experiences.
So this journey which started from Medical College Amritsar, where I trained in surgery and then started my practice in a city called Jalandhar in Punjab and moved over to Delhi. So this journey, although it's continuing, but now I feel that there's enough of data collected which needs to be shared. And this is a good platform that you're providing, so I'm very thankful to you, not only for this platform, but also for the kind words you had for me. Yes, it has been a very long journey, sometimes arduous, sometimes tedious, sometimes very pleasant also, as it would happen with any professional. But healthcare being a peculiar thing, there have been a lot of challenges, especially in the initial years, trying to find a niche, a place for myself, then the middle part of it, to look not only beyond, but also back, what has happened and how and what is going to happen. So nothing is predictable in medicine, especially it's such a rapid transition, technologically driven improvements, that I found it at times it's difficult to keep pace. See, I was trained as a general surgeon. Then it came the minimal access surgery. It was initially a plus minus situation. Whether is it going to hold good or is not going to hold good? And there was a conference where Dr. Gulwaria addressed the All India Surgical Conference. Mm-hmm. Then it was established that it's going to take place. Mm-hmm. It's going to take roots. And then that was the challenge, how to, for a person not trained in laparoscopic surgery, get training in that. Mm. Since, and my teacher also got trained after retirement.
Okay.
He got trained into this, went somewhere else, and then I also was sent in that. So that was the first challenge. Then the challenge was to help establishing this technique. There was a lot of skepticism, a lot of founded and not founded criticism also, fair, unfair both. Mm. That was one challenge. But then, over the period of time, this minimal access surgery has taken roots and is now flourishing, as all of us know. Mm. Then the challenge came when how to impart the training. I have been in a private sector. In a government sector, in a medical college, training is different. You can train people. This is how I got trained. Mm. People have been in the tradition getting trained like that.
Correct.
But in a practice, people are coming to you. And people means the junior guys, junior surgeons. I don't want them to be out in the field and finding themselves at sea. Mm. Because someone trained me. So that's that, although that was a teaching program.
Yeah.
But how do I pass on the legacy? That was another challenge.
Correct.
Then now as the things have settled more or less, now the challenge is how to make those who are following me comfortable to get into some place somewhere. Mm. Now it is like, see, like a full circle. Mm. I started from finding a place for myself.
Yeah.
But someone might have vacated the place where he got.
That is true.
So now I have to vacate it. Mm. So I have to make it, if not cozy, but as comfortable for people, somebody might come in. So that's the challenge now. So all these stages, this has been the challenge.
No, interesting challenges. I mean, you know, as we keep growing and as we keep evolving, new things keep happening in our lives. And you're absolutely right. And it's very interesting you say that one of the things that you are constantly thinking about are the people who are following you and how we must vacate place and make place for them. I mean, I think that's a very philosophical comment you've made. Otherwise, most people don't want to vacate.
Yeah, I have experienced that also. When sometimes, especially in the academic circles, I still remember a very, very senior surgeon to whom I went in all innocence in my initial years. Sir, I want to learn. You are known for this surgery. You are in a very, very well-established, large institute and country where the teachers and students are proud of being there. I was not there. Mm. But this guy I met him was introduced. I approached him that I want to learn this particular field. And the reply was, aap jo karte ho, karte raho, paisa kamao. Mm. I never entertained medicine for paisa kamao.
Absolutely.
And you are a teacher of eminence. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So that is why it makes me think that people are going to follow me. So I had to be...
No, that's a very, very noble thought, because, you know, that takes me to the next question, which is, you know, about doctors, you know, and you mentioned private sector. I was also, you know, closely associated with hospitals and Guardian Pharmacy. And one of the big challenges I used to find was that hospital owners who are investing hundreds of crores of rupees have to recover a return on their investment. And as a doctor, your commitment to your Hippocratic Oath is to meet the needs of your patient. Now, that's a big conflict that seems to be occurring in a lot of hospitals, and we see stories all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And in the recent past, it's been very, very frequent.
Mm.
And the complexion of stories, the intensity of the story,
yeah,
the narrative has changed.
Yeah.
See, when you mentioned about Hippocratic Oath, I must tell you that, yes, we were at the time of graduation, and I remember having signed oaths.
Yeah.
That will adhere by the Hippocratic Oath. But Hippocratic Oath, if you really read it, does not mention anything about the commerce of the
absolute
practice.
Correct.
It has basically something to do with the etiquettes.
Mm.
And the stress is on what I've been talking about, that I pledge that I will pass on my knowledge to the progeny of my teacher if they want to learn. Then, first preference was that. Then, all those who come to me to learn. Then, if I enter the household as a visiting physician or something, this is how well I conduct. In Hippocratic times or in Hippocratic words, this fees and commerce doesn't figure anywhere. But commonly, we are known as having sworn by the Hippocratic Oath. I must remind you that a lot of change has taken place.
Okay, and what are these changes?
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
After the World War II, the World Medical Association has brought out another oath.
Mm.
Then there are canons of American Medical Association. And then there are certain other international bodies who have come out with their own oaths. But the more noticeable is the mention which finds in the oath by the World Medical Association.
Okay.
It does mention about the word is personal profits.
I see.
So, I can't recall the exact wording, but the gist is that the thought is that whatever I do as because we call it practice, we don't call it
service.
As a medical practice, because see, the medicine is not a perfect science.
Yeah.
It is an art of healing, and it keeps on evolving. So that's how I practice. So practice not for personal profit. This is the gist of that. World Medical Association.
Right. That's a new learning for me today.
Then you see, if you look at, why only Hippocratic Oath? We know in India, there are well-known physician and surgeon known as Charak and Sushrut.
Correct.
So Charak Sanhita mentions about an oath, which is huge detailed oath.
Okay.
It mentions about the oath as a teacher, as a student, and as a practitioner.
Okay.
In different stages.
Right.
In that, it is mentioned that you are practicing. If I discard the teacher and the student part of it, come to the practitioner part of it. That as a medical, as a practitioner of healing, you are supposed to be working out of compassion.
Correct.
There, the stress or anything about personal profits or fees is not mentioned, but see. Gratification in the forms of the two kinds of gratification that you derive out of it. One is the closest that Charak comes to mentioning about the mundane things is that if someone does medical practice out of consideration of personal gains, profit, something that happens there, he will go into a heap of mud, mm-hmm. forsaking a heap of gold.
Wow.
So what is a heap of gold? It's not the physical gold. Yeah. It is the gold that one derives out of having managed a patient successfully.
Yeah.
So he says that if you work out of compassion, you will get the eventual happiness that everyone is yearning for. Mm. So this is the spiritual angle of medical practice. Mm. Charat takes it for granted that you, as a practitioner of healing, you will get something definitely, but don't go after that as the primary goal.
Right.
Now then there's another guy in the Greek pantheon again called Archimedes.
Absolutely.
So Archimedes has mentioned this thing. So see, Hippocrates and Archimedes must have been somewhere there in between the medieval age or whatever it was. But Hippocrates being a Greek philosopher, Archimedes also. Archimedes writes this in his oath that if a medical practitioner finds that a person does not need a medicine, but to justify the fees that he has charged, he must give a placebo to him. So this is the entire spectrum of the oaths.
Wow.
So in contemporary times, when you talk of an oath, we just don't talk about Charak or Archimedes, we just talk Hippocrates.
I agree. Well, that's, I think, the only word that all of us who are non-doctors have heard.
Even the doctors know. They don't know about Charak and Sushruta and Archimedes. And also the canons of American Medical Association and World Medical Association after the World War II.
Very interesting.
No one knows about.
Very
so,
interesting.
So, this is a background of the monetary part of it. Now, your thought was that the hospital owners has put in huge amount of money. So, if we again think in our own Indian context, there are three pillars of society: education, health, and religion.
Yeah.
So all the three were taken care by whom? By the state? No, by the people.
Yeah.
The education, schools, universities, gurukuls, whatever it was funded by philanthropy. So were the hospitals. Mm. Even in the times of Ashoka, we see that everything was being philanthropy. Mm. State was sponsoring, but state was sponsoring by way of the logistics, but the money part, everything. So it was a philanthropic contribution. It was not a commercial investment.
Correct.
So they don't expect it ROI. Their ROI was the number of people who were getting treated and trained. Mm. But the providers, the doctors, the chikitsak as we call them, were taken care of by the corpus given by the philanthropic guys or the state.
Yeah.
So what has happened now? Education has gone. Medicine is gone, and religion, taken over by government and all those things.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is where this edifice is crumbling.
Okay.
So now it is, so if you have to create the medical facility, which are contemporary, you have to have money in it. Mm. So when the from where does the money come? Now the money comes from the corporates, the industries. Mm. You look at most of the medical establishments are sponsored by the industry people.
Absolutely.
And if not, they become the industry. Mm. The ROI has to be there.
Has to be there.
So, but then where draws the line in this? Where somebody has to draw a line somewhere.
Absolutely.
So that is the problem.
I agree with you. I mean, I'm from the private sector and I know how important it is. If you're putting money, you need a return.
You need a return. But then to strike a balance, see, if I invest X amount of money in a hospital, how am I going to generate that money? From my business somewhere. Mm. So how am I going to sustain that? I need money in return on that. Mm. But then, how much do you need for that? That is to be seen.
Absolutely. I agree. So the Prime Minister recently spoke about a big shortage of doctors in India.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that, when I was growing up, my parents were very keen that I become a doctor and I could qualify in anything. All people who had brains got into medicine. But why is it that our medical education has not kept pace with our population?
This is an interesting aspect. See, let's talk about the Prime Minister's observation about the shortages, then the pace of the education.
Yeah.
Shortages, are they really shortages?
I don't know.
See, this shortage has come from the point of view of WHO.
Okay.
WHO has given a yardstick or a parameter or a benchmark, then that one doctor per 1,000 population. Whereas in our country, it is one doctor per 10,189.
Oh, wow.
Okay. If you look at their disease statistics, statistically, there's a shortage. But in India, who is a doctor? Definition doctor is essentially allopathy doctor. Mm. But in India, they are Ayurvedic, Vedas, they are Yunani Hakims, they are homopaths, they are naturopaths, they are Siddhas. That is why the Ministry of Ayush has come in. So, if we calculate them, I have recently read a paper that now actual the health care providers, if you don't call them doctors, let's say all them health care providers. Yeah. Well, a doctor connotes an allopathic guy. If you consider these people also, plus those who cannot be included, like the prescription of a dadi or a nani. So they are also basic healthcare given aren't they also. So if we don't exclude them, just the healthcare providers. There's a recent study, I think it was sponsored by OPPI or KPMG. I'm just forgetting, but then it was a study that now the actual ratio in India is 0.7 per thousand. It's not even one.
Really?
So there's
ample number.
Yeah. Is it a virtual shortage or an actual shortage that is to be seen?
Okay.
So what is the derivative out of this? Derivative is that, see, the fact is, by going by this KPMG study, that 80% of the physicians, means surgeons, everyone, and this is the modern system of medicine, 80% of them, physicians, 60% of the medical facilities, means hospitals, and 75% of dispensaries, they are catering to 28% of the population.
I see.
82% population is rural area. This is urban and semi-urban. So how does that happen? From that point of view, the shortage. Now, I'll tell you personal experience. I also contributed to this shortage. I had joined out of desperate or whatever it is, after qualification, the state civil services, state medical services.
Yes.
I ran out of that up exactly a month. Where the place where I used to go did not have a road. It was on the banks of Ravi River. On the other bank is Pakistan. And on this side is the upper Bari Dwarka. There was no direct road. I had to cross that Doab Canal on a borrowed bike from a friend who used to live in a city about 10 kilometers from there. I used to go there. But then what did I find? Nothing at all. I tried to find a house to live in the village. No one gave the house to me. I didn't have any family, nothing. I was fully charged up, driven to work. Government just provided a framework. Go and do duty there. I went, what could I do? I didn't even have a stethoscope to examine a patient.
Amazing.
I didn't have a suture to give stitches to an injured guy. What was this? What was my brief? The guy who was there, looking as a dispenser or something, told me, sir, these are the registers you have to fill. One tuberculosis register, one vasectomy register, and one, all the funds that come to the hospital, this dispensary and all the rest. That was my job. What would I have done? Other than running away, I ran away. I paid the bond money and signed out.
Yeah.
So this is not just one story. This is just being complete to all
thousands of people.
What is the government doing now? Recently, there was a news, Maharashtra, I think, that if you don't serve the rural, you'll be imprisoned. If you jump the bond, you'll be imprisoned. Is this the way to deal with the doctor? How can you say that? How can you compel somebody to work? Do you compel a lawyer to go and work there? Even the MLA, he doesn't reside in a village. What does he do there? How can you compel a doctor to go there? This shortage is being created. Okay. I'm narrating all this. Then about the medical education part of it. Yes, most of the colleges have not kept pace with the technological advances. But the reason is a conflict between the government and the private sector. The cost of education. That is why. See, the government sector, the bureaucracy, and in the private sector, the meritocracy of the business. That is why. You see, do you know that in the last 3 years, close to 13,000 seats have been added to MBBS in India. And there are 480 medical colleges. Still there is a shortage.
Right.
Still there is a qualitative as well as quantitative shortage. Reason is this only. I wanted to become a teacher. Why could I become? Because there are certain funding criteria.
Yeah.
They don't look at the aptitude of the person. They look at the, obviously, my, I didn't have good marks, right. So they didn't take me up.
Right.
I understand.
So moving on to another part, you know, about you as an individual. You know, you've mentioned that you're interested in searching the meaning of life through lessons learned from professional interactions with patients.
Yeah, I'm very...
I'd like to you to explain this to all our viewers with some examples.
Yeah. See, this started very early in my career. I will narrate 2-3 instances. There's one lady who had MS. There's a progressive failure of the muscles keep on failing. Eventually, when...
MS is multiple sclerosis.
That's right.
I know a little bit.
So this lady had a, what is called a gastrostomy. This is a, making a hole in the stomach so that she gets fed because she couldn't swallow. Her other system is all normal, but she couldn't swallow. And the patient knew that progressively she's going to be losing the muscles. She'd already lost the muscles of the legs. The only working muscles in her body were the fingers and the respiratory muscles. Stephen Hawking, you know. Stephen Hawking could be supported on a huge amount of technical know-how at his background. Yeah. So this lady didn't have.
Yeah.
So she used to come to me for getting that tube changed. Every now and then, after a certain period of time, that tube used to get blocked and all. She used to write in her notebook. One fine day, I suddenly found, and she used to be brought in to the hospital by her daughters. One, then there were two daughters, then one daughter stopped coming. And over the years, it lasted a few years, her interactions with me. Then I developed a rapport kind of a thing. I said, she said the daughter has got married. Yeah, fine. But then she used to write in her diary whatever she would want to communicate. Slowly, slowly, the speech was slurring. So I would know that the speech is also going on. So she would rely more on the diary. Then after that, I discovered that her diary is also, her writing is shaky and the words are not being formed. So I didn't have the courage to tell her that your hand muscles are also going. Mm. And she would smile all the times. Mm. And finally one day her diary also stopped. Mm. And the speech was slurred. Doc, I can't write anymore. Mm. And I had to look into her eyes to know what did she want. Mm. And then finally she stopped coming. Mm. And the younger daughter came one day thanking me for all, because she had gone. This is one instance. So what do we learn from this? That is why I'm trying to find out the meanings of life, the lessons of life. She knew that one day she's going to go, and she's going to go slowly. It's like death is approaching and I'm waiting. Where are you coming at?
That is true.
And she's taking her own time to come. So I learned the grit to face the eventual.
Amazing.
I don't know. I could not peep into her mind. What I could learn from this particular lady was bravery.
Yeah. Very true.
In the face of the eventual, where everything will cease to exist for her, she was always willing and smiling. And somebody's complaining about her younger daughter. She's not getting married. Why is she wasting her life after a year?
Amazing.
This was mundane thing. The other thing, other was a gentleman who had come to me with an accident. It was a touch and go situation. My juniors told me, sir, this patient has come. There is no pulse, there is no blood pressure. Only this breathing. So now this is what the challenge of surgery comes. The anesthetist said, a very guy, very competent guy, a very good friend of mine. You want to operate me? Yes. What else can you do? I know he's injured. His only thing is his breathing. And I had to do something. 52 people were with him. Each one of them not related, because his sons were this high at that time. Each one of them gave blood. We needed huge amount of blood. Because his liver had shattered. His kidney had gone. We needed blood and we needed prayers. So I saw in his friends, 52 guys. Can you imagine? Without asking anything. Hamara bilo, hamara bilo, hamara bilo. So there is, this tells me about, there is a bondage somewhere in life which need not be defined. We define the bond, say, my wife, my son, my this, my that. What do we need to define?
Yeah.
When I am reminded of that incident, So I, and that time I was working in Delhi and this guy was from Gurgaon. Now some of them, they still remember, it was God knows how many years ago.
Amazing.
Some of them, those 52 guys, they have to visit me now. Doctor sahab ne uska operation kiya tha na, hamara bhi kar do.
Amazing.
That was an emergency, this is an elective.
Yeah.
So what it tells of a bondage, it tells of a faith. Now the faith these guys demonstrate is not to be found in any scriptures or any any master's teachings. That faith is manifest.
I agree. So, you know, let me ask you another question related to this. I mean, you know, as a surgeon, there are so many patients who come to you critical. There are so many people who go away. How do you tackle this loss? I mean, how do you, how are you able to depersonalize something, because every doctor gets attached to a patient.
Mm-hmm. It happens. At times it's very difficult to sometimes. Initial years, see, there's a book I was told by my teacher that before you start surgical training, you read this book.
Mm-hmm.
This is called Bayes' Surgical Handicraft.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, there's a lesson. You can call it a chapter. I call it a lesson to convey the bad news.
Right.
There's a chapter in it.
I see.
So that book is kind of a primer for all of us.
Mm.
I think people study that now also, but we did.
Mm.
So that is how to go and talk to the patient. But when it actually comes, a pious surgical endocrine doesn't come with you.
Mm.
This happens every day, and the first time it happens, it's a shock.
Mm.
Because I had seen my seniors giving CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
Mm.
They must have discovered something wrong with their patient. I was at that time doing my internship, the junior most guy in the department. There's a lot of activity, and suddenly everything stopped.
Mm.
I start writing the notes. This end eventually declared dead at this time. Well, this word had struck me, declared dead at that time.
Mm.
So what was that? Changed patient is critical to patient was critical.
I agree.
What was the life in that patient, which we try to revive by all those CPR and injection, this, that. What was the life? So, when I was in my situation, in that position to declare one of the patients dead from my personal, those who were in my personal charge, I had this training, this background. But, yes, I pondered, I don't know for how many hours on that, that this person has gone. So that has struck. That at that time I was in my first year of my postgraduate training, and this guy had come as an accident victim. And accident victims are usually young guys. It left a deep scar on my psyche.
No, and the fact that you remember your first just shows what an impact it must have had.
So this is what it means. All of us, it happens. But surgeons maybe deal it more often. These are critical care guys, deal it more often. But over the years, it becomes a part of the
doing my
job.
Yeah. I agree. So, Rajiv, now moving to your interests, you've written a book, Carvings on Dew, and this is a book on haiku poetry. I'm going to ask you to recite a few verses, but first tell us, what is haiku poetry?
Haiku is a Japanese style of writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It is an experiential poetry.
Mm-hmm.
The essentials are that there's 17 syllables and three lines, mm-hmm. conventionally.
Okay.
These days people are writing in single line and two lines also. But since it is written in English, so it counts syllables. So mostly there are three lines. First line is 5, 7, and 5 syllables.
Okay.
And there is no poetic license in it. I cannot imagine things like in poetry. Kalidas saw a cloud and imagined, and he wrote Abhigya, this Meghadutam. A huge epic poetry. But we can't imagine in haiku.
Okay.
To experience that.
Yeah.
Whatever you experience out of your five senses,
right.
Then you mull on it. And slowly and slowly reduce into three lines, maybe two lines, and then write a poem out of that. One of the haiku poets have defined it as a semicircle,
mm-hmm.
drawn by the poet and concluded by the reader. So basically it is like as if I'm showing you that that is a moon. I cannot tell you, I can only show. So even if there is a jewel in my finger, I have to draw your attention not to the jewel but to the moon. So this is the exercise.
Okay.
I have to draw a semicircle and as a reader you complete it.
Right.
So basically there are in a classic three line English haiku, there are two images which are juxtaposed. And the central line is the pivot and the whole poem revolves around that. This is the classical English haiku.
Okay.
All they have changed. Keeps on evolving. Okay. They're not very strict about 17 syllables.
So recite one of your three line haiku poems.
Let me recall. So this is, I'll just give you a little background. This is from a visit with my family members to Leh, where we saw a monk. So the poem goes like this. So keep on visualizing this. This monk was climbing uphill. So the climbing uphill, this is the first line and it's finished. Climbing uphill, a monk turns back, not even a shadow. Climbing uphill, a monk turns back,
not even
a shadow.
Now, if you
were a haiku reader, you would naturally be drawn into this, but I will explain things to you. Climbing uphill, a monk looked back. This is one scene.
Yeah.
I saw, this is, like I told you, this is nothing imagination. You have to tell what you see, or what you feel, or what you taste, or what you touch. So this was all seen. I was sitting in the cafeteria and the monk was climbing up. There must have been his room there. It's in that Thikse monastery. It must have been his room somewhere there. So as he was climbing up, he looked back. I was trying to compose a photograph.
Yeah.
I found him very interesting to photograph going up. Whether he spotted my camera or no, I don't know. But he turned back. He turned back and then just went. So this was the scene. Now in this scene, climbing uphill, a monk looks back. The second part of this, a monk looks back, not even a shadow. So how do you react to this? It will be your own perspective.
Correct.
Somebody would say, not even a shadow would... See, haiku has certain elements. In this haiku, you have to... In haiku, you have to have a season, a part of the day, or whatever the night or whatever it is, and then a description. Now, if it is not even a shadow, it means it is noontime. Shadows, they're all centered on, not even a shadow. And now a monk looks back, whatever shadow, what does it mean? That he might be reflecting back on his years and doesn't find anything. So he has renounced everything. His slate is clear now. He can climb uphill and evolve in life.
Amazing. That's quite amazing. So, I mean, you know, I wish I had more time to keep talking. It's so fascinating. And I know that you are, you know, you are a student of scriptures and you're a multifaceted man. I'm going to get you back on this show again.
Yeah, sure.
But thank you so much for coming. I mean, incredible words of wisdom. I've learned so much from you, and I'm sure the thousands of people who will listen to you will have a lot to learn. Thank you again.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.